But we cannot generalize it for the ordinary people, saying that it's allowed for all the people to blow in the clay. Nothing will happen. You know, that's that's the reality.
Yes, and we must say that we must not lose our logic or rationality in such cases, because logic and rationality is also emphasized by the religion of Islam, isn't it? For example, to lose your mind and just follow out your feelings, and we can't say get nowhere. That's all right. Okay, we got about two more minutes. Let me ask the final question regarding this part. So what religious formula do you recommend the people in order to start, for example, their eating and drinking or the finish according to Islam? Do we have any aqaid, a special aqaid on this?
You know, in the lifestyle of the Holy Prophet ﷺ, we have that when the Prophet was drinking or wanted to drink, for example, a glass of water, a cup of water.
Yes.
First of all, Prophet drank it in, for example, three times, not once.
Yes.
This is very good to
do that. In three, for example, intervals.
Yes.
Yes, okay.
And then he would always praise the Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala before drinking, after drink.
Yes.
He did not drink water while standing.
Okay.
For example, you know. Sometimes we have these kind of things in the lifestyle of the Holy Prophet that when it comes to drinking water, we can apply these sort of things. Or when it comes to the Holy Quran, why don't we read the Holy Quran for being healed, for being created, the Holy Quran itself.
Yes.
You know, because the ayat of the Holy Quran, for example, for Surah Al-Hamd.
Yes.
We have this in riwayat that if you put your right hand on your heart and recite, directing yourself towards Qibla with wudu.
Yes.
And then write, for example, seven times Surah Al-Hamd.
Yes.
On your heart.
Yes.
Then it will, for example, help you a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, this sort of things we have when it comes to the riwayat.
That's all right. Yes. Okay. Thank you very much, Shaykh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding this topic. It was very kind of you.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. We again do supplicate to Allah to hasten the reappearance of Imam Asr, Ajalallah, Inshallah. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the significance of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z show. Dear listeners, this is Ali, and in today's episode of A to Z, we want to talk about the Islamic Revolution of Iran and the founder of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, namely Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini, Ridwanullah Ta'ala alayh, was a distinguished personality even within the world of Islam, let alone the entire world, right? He was special. He had principled stances that he took on different issues, and those stances attracted people towards Imam and his ideology. Now, when we say the path of Imam Khomeini or the ideology of Imam Khomeini, we want to look into where does he get his ideology from? What's his source? So, brothers and sisters, once we study the traditions of Prophet and Ahlul Bayt and what they have said and done in their lifetime, their seerah and, you know, their sayings, if we combine it all, we will see that Imam Khomeini's ideology traces back to the ideology of the Prophet and Imams. This is the source. And again, if you open up the Holy Quran, the divine word of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and if you look at those principles that are written in that divine book, you will see that Imam Khomeini's principles are based on those very principles. So in a nutshell, the ideology of Imam Khomeini is based on Quran, the Prophet, and the Imams, which is the Ahlul Bayt. Now, in order for us to be able to understand what the Islamic Revolution of Iran was all about, we need to be able to understand what Imam Khomeini stood for. What are his principles? What are those principles that he extracted from Quran and from the sayings and lives of Ahlul Bayt? Today we are talking about Imam Khomeini's stance regarding America. Brothers and sisters, as we said earlier, America is behind all that's gone wrong. This is the stance of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini also called America to be the Great Satan. And if you look at the slogan of Death to America, today an ever-increasing number of nations cry out loud, Death to America. Of course, it is clear that this slogan does not mean death to the American nation, but death to American policies, death to arrogance, as explained by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. He has explicitly mentioned it, that it is not about, this slogan is not about those who are themselves oppressed, an average American public. No, it is only for those who support that evil system one way or the other, and for the system itself. So death to America today, if you look at the Arabic language, it is translated as Al-Mautul Amrika. If you look at Farsi language, it is called Marg Bar Amrika. And if you look at Urdu language, it is called Murdabad Amrika.
Welcome back to your listeners.
So we're talking about this divine slogan where the reality of America is being challenged. This system of arrogance is being challenged. Today, the flag of revolution, awakening, and guidance of the Muslim Ummah is being carried by Imam Khamenei. Under his leadership, nations have not only recognized their friends and foes, but are also treading on the path of dignity, the path of honor, and the path of self-respect. Today, the oppressed nations around the globe refuse to bow down before the hegemonic and bullying policies of the United States of America, the hub of Zionism, the mother of Zionism. These fruits of the Islamic Revolution can be realized when one inspects the Islamic movement of Nigeria. You have seen what has happened to Sheikh Zakzaki. When we look at Yemen, look at the oppression being done at Yemen, right? For standing up to the arrogant policies of the front of arrogance, right? That is composed and comprised of America, Britain, Israel, Saudi Arabia, UAE, all of these culprits, they got together. For what? To oppress the general public around the globe. Look at Yemen, look at Nigeria, look at Palestine, look at Lebanon, Pakistan, and Iraq. Brothers and sisters, it is evident that the bloc of Islamic resistance is getting stronger day by day from Iran to Iraq to Syria to Lebanon. And this is thorn in the eye of the enemy of humanity. And this is what we need to know. This Death to America slogan sums it all up.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
Human rights groups have warned that the Zionist regime's stated plan to forcibly transfer more than 1.4 million Palestinians in Rafah amounts to a continuing Nakba and a genocidal act. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Israel's stated plan to forcibly transfer more than 1.4 million Palestinians in Rafah amounts to a continuing Nakba and a genocidal act. Three human rights groups said recently urging immediate international intervention. Rafah, located in southern Gaza along the border with Egypt, endured some of the deadliest hours of the Zionist regime's military offensive now in its fifth month. In the early hours of Monday, February 12th, more than 28,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been martyred since October 7th, with thousands more missing under the rubble. An untold number of Palestinians have been martyred from hunger and disease in a secondary wave of mortality resulting from the Zionist regime's military offensive and siege. The vast majority of Gaza's population of 2.3 million people have been displaced, many of them repeatedly, and most are now sheltering in Rafah in inhumane conditions. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Zionist regime's prime minister, has repeatedly threatened to expand the military offensive in Rafah in recent days, raising international alarm over the unprecedented bloodshed and mass expulsion that would all but surely entail. At least 68 Palestinians, including 19 children and 13 women, were martyred during some 2 hours of bombing early on Monday, February 12th, according to Al-Haq, Al-Mizan, and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. The Palestinian Authority's official television station said that 74 people were martyred in Rafah strikes, and that is according to Reuters. The rights group added among those killed were numerous internally displaced persons who had sought shelter in Rafah, many of whom were killed while asleep in their makeshift tents, adding, many more bodies are still under the rubble. The Zionist regime's warplanes targeted at least 15 residential buildings, 2 mosques, agricultural lands, and areas close to the Egyptian-Palestinian border, according to rights groups. The rights group added, Helicopters and gunboats were also involved in the attacks. 90 Palestinians, including 34 children, 18 women, and a journalist, were martyred in the Zionist regime's airstrikes on Rafah in the first 10 days of February. Sinai for Human Rights, an organization based in Egypt, said that on early Monday, February 12th, the Zionist regime bombed areas along the Gaza-Egypt border fence, which Cairo has reinforced due to fears of a mass expulsion of Palestinians from Gaza. The three Palestinian human rights groups said that the people amassed on Gaza's border with Egypt had fled to the area at the command of Israeli military on the instruction that Rafah was a designated safe zone. The groups added that the intensified targeting of Rafah comes as the Zionist regime's military continues to empty out Gaza City and forcibly displaces residents southward toward Deir al-Balah and Khan Yunis, forcing Palestinians south to Rafah and then announcing the displacement of people in that area, whether internally into smaller pockets of Gaza into Egypt with no basic necessities for survival, is further evidence of the Zionist regime's genocidal intent. An unnamed senior Israeli regime military official told Axios that it had pounded Rafah early on Monday, February 12th, as a diversion while its forces freed two Israeli-Argentine men held in Gaza after being captured during the October 7th events. Of the more than 240 Israelis and foreign nationals who were captured on October 7th, around 130 remain in Gaza after around 100 were freed in a prisoner exchange during a week-long truce in late November. Recently, the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of resistance movement Hamas, announced that two captives were killed and eight were seriously injured in the Zionist regime's strikes during the preceding days. The Zionist regime's military said 31 of the remaining captives in Gaza had been declared dead and their families notified. While international pressure for a ceasefire builds, Netanyahu has vowed to press on, telling an American television program that enough of the remaining captives in Gaza were alive to justify continuing the military operation. Last week, Netanyahu rejected a proposal for a prisoner exchange and an extended pause in fighting put forward by the resistance group Hamas. Reuters reported recently that senior officials from the United States, Egypt, the Zionist regime, and Qatar are due to resume negotiations in Cairo. Sources told Reuters that they are seeking a three-phase deal framework that will see the release of hostages and achieve an extended pause. Recently, U.S. President Joe Biden reiterated to Netanyahu over the phone that Washington opposes a military operation in Rafah in the absence of a real plan to protect civilians sheltering there. The airstrikes that killed dozens of civilians in Rafah came just hours after that phone call. Recently, Biden told reporters following talks with Jordan's King Abdullah that Washington was working to secure a deal that would hold hostilities for at least 6 weeks. Asked what kind of leverage the U.S. was applying on the Zionist regime, the U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said recently that diplomatic levers had been used and we have engaged with the Israelis on a multitude of levels. Miller added that those efforts had caused the Zionist regime to take steps at urging that have had real, tangible impact, but they have not been enough. He claimed, when the United States of America stands up and says something publicly, it matters.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
A'udhu billah minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, who has given us multiple opportunities for self-improvement, empowerment, and perfection. One of the ways of which is becoming a parent. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. A warm salam to all of you, dear brothers and sisters, to the Imam of our time, Imam Mahdi ajalallahu ta'ala farjuhu sharif, for whom we are raising and educating a future generation to become as part of his commanders in faith. And assalamu alaikum to the respected Sayyid in our studio, Sayyid Salman Naghawi.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
So you're listening to Islamic Upbringing at IRIB English Radio. You can listen to us online at parstoday.ir. You can also refer to our social media, Instagram and Facebook, at Call of Islam Radio. And please do feel free to write to us your comments and questions if you disagree with us. If you have, you know, newer perspectives that you would like to share with us, please write to us at our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir. Sayyid Salman Naghawi, our dear expert, is an academic board member, faculty member in Al-Mustafa International University. And we've been talking a lot about the two parenting styles of transformational and transactional parenting. And we said that we always have to be educating ourselves as parents to have logical dialogues based on hikmah, wisdom, and not merely a monologue. We talked about the importance of love, of understanding, of listening to our children. So in this program, we want to mention some practical examples so that you will have a better understanding and grasp of the idea of transformational parenting for all ears.
Yes, thank you very much. You've given a good introduction. And based on your introduction, we need to come up with some practical examples. For example, when we want to compare between transactional and transformational leadership, parenting, as and we mentioned before, parenting is a culmination of two skills, educational skills and leadership skills and qualities. Because education wants, basically an educationist wants to bring about behavioral change, any educator. Not just in the formal sense. We're not talking about education in the formal sense necessarily. It's in an informal way also. Parenting is educating people in an informal environment. People learn formally when they go to school, college, university. They learn informally in society. And the first building block of society is the family. So a parent has to be a teacher, a guide, a mentor, educationist, in the informal sense. So he, and then education is for bringing about behavioral change based upon three inner things: knowledge, skills, and attitudes. Even our skills are the psychomotor skills through which we carry out many things practically, are hidden in our body. The potential, for example, if you're you may be a good driver, but now you're sitting here in front of me, you're not driving practically, but the skill to be able to drive is has been actualized, the potential there is actualized, but your child may not be a driver. So those skills are there within you. So the these knowledge, skills and attitude coming together makes you competent to carry out behavior, good behavior, for the sake of Allah. So competence and good behavior are very much intertwined. And the good behavior for an educationist is to be able to bring about behavioral change in the person who he's educating. And in this case, we're talking about our children. And a leader also wants to people to do things, the best things possible. He wants things to be done in the way that it should be carried out. He wants people to do what he likes, wants them to do, but does not impose upon them. So we said there are two styles. One is imposing, authoritative. The other is inspirational, motivational. So we come to a situation where, for example, which type is going to be appropriate, transactional or, for example, transformational? Now, let's talk about a situation. Beginning of 2020s, we had this outbreak of corona.
Mm-hmm.
People were forced to live inside their homes.
Can we go for a short break and then we'll listen to your story?
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. Sayyid Nahawi was trying to tell us, depict for us a picture from the time of the corona. Sayyid, we're all ears.
So at the time of the corona outbreak, epidemic situation that we had, now the governments were enforcing these rules and they wanted us to remain at home. We're not talking about the pros and cons. We're talking about what happened actually.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our children had to be forced. So one would say, look, transactional leadership is what's going to get the things done. If you want to give them, argue with them, and you want to
give them choice of you can do that, you cannot do that, that wasn't the case.
That wasn't the case. Yes, maybe that would be a case for transactional leadership and parenting. But even there, in that situation, if the children, especially the grown-up ones, the teenagers, the youngsters, the very small children, you need to force them to remain at home. But the teenagers, you could discuss with them,
mm-hmm.
and make the decision based on their free choice.
It was so scary that you didn't even have to provide logic and reason for them. It was a matter of life and death, and they saw all around them, like on the news, in the radio, in their loved ones, in their akin, relatives, whatever.
Exactly.
They saw a lot of people dying and a lot of people being
themselves reasoning that but just in case there were some the odd people out, the youngsters who want to say no, what's happened, there's nothing wrong in it. So even there you could use the transformational way of discussing and talking about the situation, and if they were not going to listen to you, then they would have to face the consequences themselves.
Mm-hmm.
they would catch the flu or whatever was there,
I think the parents' logic and dialogue with the family members could have been in the channel of providing, because fear was rampant. It was all over the place, thinking that any time they could catch the flu and they would die, right? So, and because they had to abandon going to work, parents, they had to all be secluded in one enclosed area. This created a lot of challenges between the family members. So the role of the parents at that time, I think, was to cool down and to bring peace and to minimize the friction and the challenges between the family members, right?
Of course, there were many conspiracy theorists about rampant there also. They were saying, though, it's all been made up by the powers to be, and they, creating a new situation. I'm not talking about that, but still, there were people who would tend to look at the conspiracy theories and say, it's all a hoax, it's nothing really happening. In any case, I mean, just we're talking about a situation. For example, nowadays, for example, we want our children, number one, we want them to be good students. Now, sometimes we want them to become doctors because we're doctors. Or
we wanted to be doctors.
We wanted to be doctors. Now we want them to. No, we can't force them to become a doctor. For example, there's a religious scholar. He wants his child to become a religious scholar. We can't force it. You can't compel it. Compel him to do so, like Rahafuddin. You can't.
Right.
So he has to do it out of his free choice. The thing that you can provide is the opportunity, the environment where he can develop, think independently, this thinking and this understanding that this is a choice that can be made and this is the requirements for it.
Right.
And then we have to acquire those things. I mean, especially when we're talking about, for example, when you're talking about the teenagers, we're talking about the age when they're preparing for high college, university.
Right.
And then high school.
Right.
Now, which in some systems of education, like in America, maybe till grade 12, it's all one comprehensive program of studies.
Right.
In other places, you have different fields starting at high school, like in Iran, in Pakistan, in other places, and even in England, you have different choices, whether you'd lead to the pre-medical, go to pre-medical or pre-engineering. Now you need to give them counseling. You need to make them make the proper decision. The important thing is you need to make them good learners. In whatever field they go, the competence you want them to develop is the competence to become good students, to learn, to bring about a change in themselves, to be able to bring about change in society. They need to become reformers and leaders in whatever. That is important. Whether they become doctors, they become engineers, they become religious scholars.
Whether a carpenter.
Even a carpenter. Even whatever field.
Whatever field.
Even IT, whatever. They have to be leaders in that field. They have to be independent, creative people in whatever field they go. This is important, that we create productive people, we create competent people, but making them to choose a path which we think it should be chosen is wrong. We give them the choices, we provide, and look at their potential, look at their aptitude, they look at what they want.
This took me to the story of the blacksmith and that alim who desired to meet with the 12th imam, and for 40 days he was trying so hard, you know, to abstain from certain things, to go to certain places with the desire and the hope and wish of meeting the 12th imam. And once he was directed to go to a bazaar where an old blacksmith was doing transactions. And he went there and he was an observer for a couple of minutes. And what did he see? He saw that an old woman came with a lock that, you know, she was needed to sell it. And she gave it to the blacksmith, and the guy said, well, this is worth this much. The lady was so surprised. She was like, well, I went to so many different blacksmiths. They offered a much lower price. He said, well, this is the exact price of what I can offer you. So when you were talking, it really doesn't matter where you are, at what position you are in the society. And then that scholar, that alim, realized that the imam of the time comes to visit him. He doesn't have to try hard for 40 days to go here and there to meet the imam. These are real leaders of the society.
Exactly.
And this brings us to the end of another episode of the program, Islamic Upbringing. Thank you very much for listening. Wa akhiru da'wana an alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Liberal Democrats say last month an average of 5,735 people a day face waits of 12 hours or more to be seen in accidents and emergency departments in hospitals. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. More than 1.5 million patients in England had to wait 12 hours or longer in accidents and emergency departments in the past year, according to figures that MPs say lay bare the impact of the government's neglect of the National Health Service. Last month, 177,805 patients faced waits of 12 hours or more to be seen in emergency departments, an average of 5,735 a day. It means 1 in 10 patients, or 12.4% of patients, arriving at accidents in emergency departments waited 12 hours before being admitted, transferred or discharged. In total, between February of 2023 and January of 2024, 1,540,945 patients experienced long waits, according to analysis of official data by the Liberal Democrats. Every day, thousands of patients are being left scared and in pain in overcrowded accidents and emergency departments, waiting for 12 hours or more to receive the care that they need, according to Daisy Cooper, the Liberal Democrats' health spokesperson. Daisy Cooper added, "These devastating delays lay bare the stark impact of this government's neglect of the National Health Service." January was the worst month in the past year as winter pressures struck. In some hospitals, 1 in 4 patients faced delays of 12 hours or more. One 88-year-old woman was left waiting 16 hours, according to the Liberal Democrats. The analysis showed the actual amount of time patients spent in accidents and emergency departments after arriving before being admitted to hospital, transferred or discharged. The figures are separate from last week's published trolley wait figures, which only measure the time taken after a decision to admit a patient has been made. The number of people waiting more than 12 hours in accidents and emergency departments from a decision to admit them to actually being admitted to hospitals soared to 54,308 in January, up sharply from 44,045 in December. This was the second highest figure on record, just below 54,573 in December of 2022. The number of people who waited at least 4 hours from the decision to admission also grew, from 148,282 in December to 158,721 last month. Again, the second highest figure on record. Long waits at accidents and emergency departments have been linked to serious patient harm. The Royal College of Emergency Medicine has previously highlighted data showing that once people wait more than about 6 hours and need to be admitted into hospital, their risk of dying starts to increase. Daisy Cooper said, "Waits of 12 hours or more can have catastrophic consequences for people's health, particularly the elderly and vulnerable people. No one should have to wait this long for care, yet in some areas, this unacceptably long delays have become almost the norm. It's time Conservative ministers started taking this National Health Service crisis seriously instead of ignoring all the warning signs while patients are suffering. The Department of Health and Social Care said accidents and emergency performance was improving despite winter pressures and the highest number of January accidents and emergency attendances on record. We're determined to continue improving patient care, having already delivered on our promise to create 5,000 extra permanent hospital beds and 10,000 hospital at home beds, freeing up capacity and cutting waiting times, according to a spokesperson. British newspaper The Nottingham Post has also covered this story. More than 1,000 people were stuck waiting for over 12 hours in accidents and emergency departments in Nottinghamshire last month. The latest data from the National Health Service has shown a dramatic increase in patients experiencing a 12-hour wait to be admitted to accidents and emergency departments in January over the last 8 years. A total of 900 patients at Nottingham University Hospital's NHS Trust and 224 patients at Sherwood Forest Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust had a 12-hour wait to be admitted to accidents and emergency in January, according to the latest data from the National Health Service. That's up from 855 last January at Nottingham University Hospital's and 289 at Sherwood Forest Hospitals. In January of 2022, there were 514 and 40 at the two respective hospitals who had to wait over 12 hours to be admitted. Back in January of 2019, there were none at either NHS Trust, nor in January of 2018, while in 2017 there were just two patients at Nottingham University Hospitals. Nationally, a total of 54,308 patients had a 12-hour wait to be admitted to accidents and emergency this January. This is the second highest number on record, behind only December of 2022, when 54,573 people had to wait over 12 hours. The Liberal Democrat website has also covered this story and tells us more. A staggering 1.5 million patients in England waited 12 hours or more after arriving at accidents and emergency departments over the past year, new analysis by the Liberal Democrats has revealed. The figures revealed a true scale of the accidents and emergency delays over a 12-month period for the first time. Shockingly, at some NHS trusts, over 1 in 4 patients are facing delays of 12 hours or more after arriving at accidents and emergency departments. The Liberal Democrat said it showed that 12-hour delays had become almost the norm in some areas of England. The previously hidden data from NHS England shows the actual amount of time patients spent in accidents and emergency after arriving before being admitted to hospital, transferred or discharged. These figures are separate from the regularly published trolley wait figures, which only measure the time taken after a decision to admit a patient has been made. The latest figures show that in total, 1,540,945 patients faced waits of 12 hours or more after arriving at accidents and emergency between February of 2023, when the new data was first published, to January of 2024. This equates to almost 1 in 10 or 9.6% of patients during that period, 5 times higher than the National Health Service requirement that no more than 2% of patients should wait 12 hours or more. Shockingly, it means an average of over 4,200 patients waited over 12 hours at accidents and emergency departments every day over the past year. January saw the worst figures yet as winter pressure stuck, with a record 177,805, or 1 in 8 patients, that is 12.4%, facing accidents and emergency waits of over 12 hours. At Blackpool Teaching Hospitals, over 1 in 4 patients in January faced accidents and emergency delays of 12 hours or more, the worst in the country. This was followed by Shrewsbury and Telford Hospital with 25.4%. Research from the Royal College of Emergency Medicine has previously estimated that for every 82 admitted patients whose transfer to a hospital bed is delayed beyond 6 to 8 hours from arrival, there is one extra death. Liberal Democrat health spokesperson Daisy Cooper, MP, said, "These devastating delays lay bare the stark impact of this government's neglect of the National Health Service. Every day, thousands of patients are being left scared and in pain in overcrowded accidents and emergency departments waiting for 12 hours or more to receive the care that they need. Waits of 12 hours or more can have catastrophic consequences for people's health, particularly the elderly and the vulnerable. No one should have to wait this long for care, yet in some areas these unacceptably long delays have become almost the norm."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019, you should know that if ignorance of the revolution's mottos and negligence of the revolutionary movement had not occurred in some periods during the 40-year history of the revolution, which unfortunately existed and were extremely detrimental, the revolution's accomplishments would have gone far beyond what we witness today, and the country would have been far ahead on the path towards the great ideals, and many of the current problems would not have existed today. Today, just like the first days after the revolution, sovereign Iran faces challenges from the imperialist, arrogant powers. Yet, there is a meaningful difference.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If the challenges posed by the United States those days involved ending the intrusion by foreign agents or closing down the embassy of the Zionist regime in Tehran, or exposing the spy den, the former U.S. embassy in Tehran, today the challenges concern Iran's strong presence near the borders of the Zionist regime, putting an end to the United States' unlawful infiltration in the West Asia, the Islamic Republic's support of the Palestinian people's resistance at the heart of the occupied territories, as well as defending the high-flying flag of Hezbollah and the resistance throughout this region. If, then, the West's concern was to prevent Iran from buying basic weaponry, today their concern is to prevent the transfer of advanced Iranian weapons to the resistance forces. If on those days the United States presumed that the Islamic government and the Iranian nation could be vanquished with the help of a few Iranian sellouts and a small number of aircrafts and helicopters, today they feel they need a coalition of tens of hostile or daunted states to counter Iran on the political and security fronts. And yet they fail. Thanks to the revolution, Iran today stands out at an elevated position, one that the Iranian nation deserves to enjoy in front of the world. And Iran has already passed the challenging twists on the path of resolving its fundamental issues.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Agreements marking a significant step forward in enhancing economic relations between Iran and Armenia. 19 MOUs that lay down the framework for expanding mutually beneficial bilateral cooperation in a wide range of areas. Iran and Armenia's economic relations have consistently strengthened over the past couple of years, with bilateral trade reaching $1 billion U.S. dollars, and now both sides are ready to take it to the next level.
For both our countries, there is great potential to boost trade, and we are adamant about using all the capacities to expand our relations. I have to note that promoting political and economic relations with Iran has been high on the agenda of the government of Armenia. We attach great importance to our relations with Iran in all fields.
This is all in line with agreements to increase bilateral trade in two phases made in 2022 during the Armenian Prime Minister's visit to Tehran.
According to the agreements made in 2022 and the first phase, we set a target for a trade volume of $1 billion. And now we are taking the necessary measures to increase that by threefold. In order to reach this objective, we are signing agreements that cover 19 areas of economic cooperation.
The recently signed Eurasia Free Trade Agreement is expected to facilitate the implementation of these MOUs by eliminating custom duties. So, we are on the right track.
These developments come at a time when Iran has been an anchor for peace, with sparks of tension every now and then between Armenia and Azerbaijan turning into an issue of concern. Therefore, in the big picture, these scenes could translate into measures that go beyond traditional rhetoric, encouraging stability in the region.
Iran and Armenia are taking practical steps to expand business and trade relations, taking their economic ties to the next level, at a time when these ties seem crucial to establish peace and security in the region. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Yemenis from all walks of life gathered in the capital Sana'a and other cities to reaffirm their unwavering support for their Palestinian brothers and the resistance forces. People from as far away as Saudi Arabia's Najran province joined the gathering.
We, the tribes and nobles of Najran, came here in response to the call by Abdul Malik al-Houthi to support the people of Gaza. We declare from Sana'a that we are with Ansarullah in standing against the Zionists and the Americans who are committing genocide in Gaza. All Arabs and Muslims must stand by Gaza as it is a religious, national and humanitarian duty.
The position of the Yemeni people is consistent with its leadership. They are all in one accord with Palestine and with the axis of resistance. It is necessary to act with one's heart and soul. People have come out today to express their position and steadfastness until Palestine is liberated.
The protesters condemned the Israeli aggression against Rafah on the border of Egypt and urged their armed forces to intensify naval operations in response to the regime's war crimes in Rafah. They expressed willingness to join the Yemeni armed forces and fight against those who commit horrible crimes against innocent civilians in Gaza.
All Yemenis, young and old, men and women, learn to use all types of weapons, from pistols to automatic rifles, anti-aircraft guns and missiles. Everyone is preparing for the decisive battle with the Zionists. When we declare that we are ready, it is not to brag in the media, but rather we are truly prepared to confront America, Israel and those with them.
Earlier, the spokesman for the Yemeni army stated that the forces had successfully targeted a British ship in the Gulf of Aden using naval missiles. He also pledged to continue preventing Israeli-linked vessels from sailing through the Bab al-Mandeb Strait until the Israeli genocide stops.
People here believe that it is time for Muslims around the world to unite against the Israeli enemy and its backers. They call on the people across the Arab world to take to the streets and initiate concrete actions against the Israeli atrocities in Gaza. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
On the martyrdom anniversary of three prominent leaders, Hezbollah Secretary General vowed that the resistance will retaliate for the Israeli strikes that killed civilians in South Lebanon, considering them deliberate massacres.
I tell friend and foe, the enemy will pay in blood for the bloodshed of our women and children in the last few days in Nabatea and Sawana and other towns of South Lebanon.
Analysts believe Nasrallah's words are very significant, but so is his deliberate silence on several issues.
This is the general approach with Sayyid Hassan always takes, trying to keep the enemy always in a state of psychological fear, not expecting or not being able to anticipate how the retaliation might come.
Hezbollah declared it launched a first retaliation for the massacres by launching Katyusha rockets against targets in Kiryat Shmona. But the leader of the resistance responded to the Israeli war minister Yoav Gallant's threats against Lebanon, saying the rocket capabilities of the Lebanese resistance goes beyond that.
Perhaps Gallant has forgotten that the resistance possesses a massive and precise missile power that enables it to strike Kiryat Shmona and all the way to Eilat.
He also underlined that the resistance front in the region as a whole has been able to enforce a balance of power, which bars the Israelis and the United States from achieving their goals.
He said that the Yemenis, in the action they took, did not resort to focusing on the Americans in their military operations, but rather continue to focus on Israel. And he said that that must remain the strategy. So I think that that's a very important. Sayyid Hassan continues to set realistic goals and to focus on weakening the Israeli side